Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Fill her up!
You're listening to the Gas Digital Network.
What is up, my fellow addicts? Ralph Sutton, the SDR Show. This week, a man who was homeless and a heroin addict till he was nearly 30, and now he is Billy Idol's guitarist. He is a crazy successful artist, and he comes on to tell some great stories to me and Big J Okerson. Oh, and he also happens to be Ozzy Osbourne's best friend for the last 25 years or something like that. Really interesting dude. Billy Morris comes on Zoom, actually, if I'm being fully transparent. But if you're doing anything, it should be subscribing to the show on YouTube, Spotify, iTunes, Google, wherever you listen to the show. That's all we care about, although I just heard Google's podcast app is shutting down. So I guess YouTube Music or whatever they call it these days. But here it is right now, the Billy Morrison episode. By the way, use code SDR14. You get a 2-week free trial at gasdigital.com and get access to every show we've ever done commercial free in 5 days. Well, actually, 14 days early. There you go. So here it is right now, the Billy Morrison episode of the SDR Show.
This is the intro to the shit show. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. This is a hit show. Show me a tit show. Please, someone walk the hole. It's weed, I'm beat. It's hookers and blow. It's art, it's far. You need to know. The SDR Show. Let's go.
It is the SDR Show, sex, drugs, and rock and roll show. A rare occurrence of a Zoom with me and Big J Okerson, which means it's going to be a special show. First of all, Big J, how are you, Big J? I haven't seen you since Wednesday.
Well, it's been pretty crazy a week so far. We did the Paramount, me and Bobby Kelly. Turns out they give you the brick whether you sell it or not. So,
oh, that's good.
The Paramount Theater in Huntington gives you the brick either way, which I felt like it was a pity brick. I almost broke it. and I've been at Levity all weekend. Yeah, just running around. You know me, yeah, nonstop.
You're a busy boy. That's what's amazing is that if you make time on a weekend to do the show with me, it means it's a special event. So I'm going to give this guy the
intro. Well, we got a good guess. This isn't one of your fucking juice restaurant fucking goofball friends.
Well, we'll start with a former bass player of The Cult, born in England, a guitarist for Billy Idol for a very long time, co-founder of Royal Machines, artist, actor, writer, also a hologram, a super successful artist. We're going to get into all of that. New album that is just about to come out. The second single that, God damn it sounds like it came off a 90s Aussie record. It's fucking wild. Called Crack Cocaine. We'll get into it all. It is Billy Morrison. Welcome to the show, sir. How are you?
Thank you. And no offense to you, Ralph, but I will point out that when I got the email to do your show, and Big J was, I can't do that day. I said, yeah, well, we'll wait.
I don't take offense. You know what's funny is that it happens more and more these days. Jay, you know, when we first started the show, Jay, you'll admit this too, I would think. Maybe it was 10 years ago.
Of course.
I had a radio show that was on 100 stations. I was the more well-known name at the time. Fair?
Oh, absolutely.
And now, boy, did that fucking scale switch the other
direction. Me and Ralph have been friends long enough that I went to Ralph. I'll never forget this. Just calling Ralph and being like, hey, Ralph, that money from Shiprock coming yet? And he's like, why? Do you need it? Like, it didn't come through yet. He's like, and Ralph met me up to give me like some cash to hold me over like a junkie. Yeah.
Fucking awesome. Now, to be clear, Ralph, I'm a fan and I knew you were. But I drive around LA, despite people probably think I drive around headbanging and rocking out. All I listen to is comedy because it stops me getting out of my car on the 405 freeway and kicking the shit out of someone's car.
Yeah.
It calms me down. So I'm listening to, you know, my buddy Jim Norton and Jay and all of the guys. And I'm just happy driving around giggling and laughing. You know, it's better for me.
And what I have found over the last 10 years of doing the show with Jay is that every comic wants to be a rock star and every fucking rock star wants to be a comic. It's pretty wild.
Well, I don't want to be a comic. I'm not that funny.
Well, you know, I tell you, it was Jonathan Davis from Korn in a conversation over a cigarette we had, kind of told me like at least his theory on that, which I thought sounded pretty good. And it was that comedians look to music, not even if they want to be each other, but what they envy about each other at all is comics envy that going out there and just having these people like yell back the words at you that you like, you know, wrote while you were taking a shit one day, or, you know, in the back of a car, just wrote, jotting down some lyrics, and it means something to these people. And he said that comics envy that, and musicians envy that comics. It's like a one-man show. There's no crutch, is how he described it. There's no, it's just you control that same room with just your words. No, you can't like just start playing and put your head down and get through it. Like, you have to engage in it.
That is, and it's so true. That's exactly why I paint as well. I'm sure you'll brush on it. I have a fine art career because there ain't no managers or agents telling you it doesn't go like that. Yeah. It's just me and a paintbrush. It's the soul. It's me being a comic in my own house.
Well, the fascinating thing I've always felt is they're both auditory platforms, right? But one, all you want to do is hear what you know, and the other, all you want to do is hear new shit. It's very weird that way. That they're both auditory, but they just fit differently.
That's extremely interesting. A thing I've always thought, and some comics have historically responded to that. I think it was I want to say it may have been Bernie Mac or one of the original kings of comedy said that about, like, he goes, Mariah Carey goes out and sings the same songs, I'm going to go out and tell the same jokes, which is kind of good. But it really is right. If you go up there and just keep doing, eventually people will go, same set. But I mean, if you went and saw, like, you know, Guns N' Roses was like, we're going to, for the rest of this thing, we're just, you know, extreme hits only. Then you're like, yeah, please. Like, we're going to put out a new song. I always thought that was interesting that Iron Maiden like does that. Like every other album, they go and play the album and like five hits, and the other one they'll do it. I'm like, that's balls to the wall to do
it
that.
Wild. Yeah. Do you find hard, Billy?
We'd
do you find that hard?
Strung up. If we didn't play Rebel Yell, we'd get strung up.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Fuck yeah. So let's go back to because you're, I've said this a few times on the show, not that often, but when I research someone, sometimes it's like, well, holy shit, that's wild. So we're going to start with you back growing up in England, right?
All right.
At 14 years old, you get addicted to heroin, right?
Yep.
And you are in it for fucking till you're 29 almost, right? The couple things that are crazy
good run.
Is that
that's a good run.
That's a good run. It is a good run.
I was a professional, Jay. I was consummate professional.
It's a good time to do it and a great time to stop when you stop.
Exactly. Yeah.
You did it perfectly.
It took him. There was 24 different rehabs, approximately, right? It wasn't until 19 that you realized it was a problem. It took you 5 years. To say, oh, wait a minute, maybe I shouldn't be doing this. And then also, which I think is not so much a problem now, but certainly was then, you see Johnny Thunders and you're like, well, that dude looks cool. He doesn't have a fucking care in the world. I want to do what he's doing. And that's what launched your heroin addiction. Is that a good summation?
First of all, I'm impressed. I mean, what a great research. And all of that is true. I had no idea what heroin addiction meant, but Johnny was skinny. And he looked cool, and Sid looked like he didn't give a fuck. So I was like, okay, that's what I have to do. And it wasn't until about 5 years in when I actually started to try and stop that I realized it was, oh, I can't stop. It's a problem. I get sick. So, yeah, that's true.
Fucking wild. You know, so you are out there. I'm sorry, Jay, go ahead.
I didn't say anything.
Oh, sorry. And then at some point, you moved to L.A. because you figured I'd rather be with palm trees at a 7-Eleven than be where I am, even if I'm still not in a good place. At least it's nice out. But it didn't take. And somebody brought you back to England.
Yeah.
And then you almost, I think you almost died. And so that's when you had that moment of clarity.
The didn't take bit happened when I first came to L.A. because I was here in the riots and using really badly. I was homeless. I wasn't Beverly Hills homeless where you're staying on your friend's mother's couch in the back house of the mansion. I was living under a piece of corrugated iron lent up against someone else's fence on sixth and Alvarado, you know, down there. So that got really gnarly. That was a couple of years. And the rehabs didn't take.
One of them finally does, and you know, which I'm going to bring him on my health show, Jay, making fun of my health show, because it is such a fascinating story, and we'll go more into it. But what's crazy is, you know, your first big break in music would be bass for The Cult, which you're not a bass player, you're a guitarist. Also, which is fascinating. You, although I said at the top of the show, an actor.
That's how little people respect bass players and people who just play bass. You just get a, guitarist and he goes, yeah, just play. You play the bass. It's probably that easy.
Let me tell you, Jay, you are so spot on. Here's the facts and figures is, it's not quite correct. My first big break was I signed to Geffen.
That album eventually came out. It didn't come out, though, didn't it, right?
It did. The album came out, but I got this big record deal. I was the front man and the guitar player, and I've always been a guitar player. Yes, I got a call to join The Cult, which was definitely into arenas and the big time. Mm-hmm. And yes, it was, well, you know you're a guitar player, but you can play the bass, right? And to what Jay just said, I was in The Cult for just over 2 years. I've been a professional guitar player for 29, and I've been with Billy Idol for 16 years. And every headline I read is ex-bass player of The Cult. I can't get away from it.
That's funny. That is fucking hilarious. Was it hard to learn bass, or is it, as Jay said, it was just, I could play guitar, I could play bass?
Well, look, if you're going to be Chris Chaney, who just joined AC/DC, he's our bass player in Royal Machines. That's a lifetime of practice. There's bass players and there's bass players. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't up there, but it's right. The Cult. So it's 16th notes and it's usually the note D. So if you just keep going on D, you're going to be right. You know, so I wasn't a pro bass player. It was just, you know.
How much else said whenever someone in the audience tells me they play, what do you play? They go, bass. I go, no, but I mean, like, you play the guitar, and like, they already had a guitar in the band you joined. It's like, no, just bass. I go, come on, man.
There's a definite hierarchy, and I definitely wouldn't want to be a drummer either.
Yeah. It's being the triangle. I play the triangle.
Yeah, exclusively. Then everything else, right? For sure. And but that album, Stimulator, that was with Geffen. They either went under or something, yeah. And you had to win back the rights to get that record to finally come out, right?
Yeah, there was Geffen got bought out by Seagram's. It was the biggest single merger in music business history. And of course, there I am, poised with this big album to come out, and I'm in the middle of it. And there were so many huge artists involved. Guns N' Roses were on, everyone was on. And our lawyer went in and just said, look, just give us the album back and a bit of money, and we'll just go away. Mm-hmm. And so that's what happened. So the album came back to me. I owned it, and I sat on it for 15 years and then thought, this is a great album. I'm going to put it. I wrote all the songs and I was the singer and I played, you know, it was my album anyway. So fuck it.
You know, Ralph, what was the band? Was that was it Wheatus by any chance? What was the band that said they, and it's becoming a thing I'm hearing a lot now, bands going and just re-recording.
Yeah, it was Wheatus.
They go and re-record a classic album and it's just a way to beat the system on getting your rights back.
Talk to Taylor Swift, Joe.
Yeah, Taylor Swift.
Yeah,
she's right.
She's going to do that. She's going to do the whole thing. Re-record everything, right?
Wow. Yeah.
What a back door to something that was like extreme legal battles for years and years over. I remember when I was on tour with Korn, and I was saying that I wanted to use at one point Blind. It was to open a special, but it was like half hours. It was a million years ago. And I told him that I wanted to do that, but they couldn't afford the licensing for it, and he was like, oh yeah, he's like, well, that has nothing to do with me anyway. He's like, and I think it's funny, it has passed since, but he was like, Sony owns it for like 6 more years or something, and then like, and then we get it back. But it's like, he's like, he has nothing to do, he's like, I could play it live anywhere. Yeah. But I he's like, I own like the rights to perform it. He goes, but nothing they do with that song I could ever be paid for.
I was hilariously quoted in Newsweek because when Taylor Swift had to re-record her records, somehow I was asked, and I said, every 80s rock band has done this because they had shitty deals and they're trying to get back their recording. So many of them did that back in the day. So it's nothing new.
I notice it in moments where I'm like, a very specific song I hear a lot that must have been done for that reason is Shout Out the Devil. There's two versions of Shout Out the Devil that exist. One just sounds a little bit newer and a little more like, you know, like a studio, and the other one's it's sang a little different even.
I think that one's on the Carl's Jr. commercial.
Yeah,
you're right.
And there's a reason for that, because if you re-record it and take out the word devil, there's $1 million right there.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's crazy. That is crazy. Damn. That's wild. So you actually knew Billy Duffy back in the day. There's a story where he stepped over what he thought was your dead body.
Yeah.
As living in squalor, for lack of better words. And that's kind of how you two know each other initially.
Ralph,
right?
you're very impressive. Yes.
Thank you.
So back in the day in the 80s.
Wait, before you tell a story, I just want you to know, Billy, it's actually that he's alone and has no love in his life. So all he has to do is thumb through fun facts about people.
Really, really sleazy internet sites.
Yeah, he knows a creepy amount about you. It's beyond
how much time I have when you don't have an accidental daughter from 22 years ago.
Are you gonna knock on my front door in a minute, Ralph?
Yeah, oh, by the way, we've only scratched the surface of what I found out, my friend.
Yeah, Billy Duffy. So obviously we were both in Brixton, which is an area of Southeast London that back in the 80s, that's where all the riots were and the Yardies and the Jamaican gangsters. And that's where the heroin was. So that's where I was. Hmm. And apparently, I actually don't remember, but Duffy's told me this, where I used to go and score, he wasn't a drug addict, but he was renting a room in that apartment. And apparently many times he used to come out of it. He had his door triple padlocked, right? And he'd stay in his room. But when he needed to go out, he'd open the door and he'd be stepping over me,
Jesus,
passed out in the front room, you know, like OD'd and all the rest of it. So he remembers that. I don't.
And weren't you also briefly in a band with the other members of Southern Death Cult too?
I was, yeah. Yeah, yeah. It was Barry Jepson from Southern Death Cult and B from Dance Society. Yeah, we had a band there.
Can I ask you, as somebody who got on the other side of like a heroin addiction, you know, I make the joke, well, if somebody in the audience ever says, you know, they used to do heroin or something, I'm always like, well, you wrote a few songs at least, right? And and if they say no, I'm like, what a waste of heroin.
All right, before we go any further, if you like well-crafted small batch cigars, this is the place for you. Smallbatchcigar.com. Not only do you get 5% reward points instantly, but if you use the code GAS10, you're going to get 10% off the entire order. So 10% plus 5% reward points at smallbatchcigar.com. They come in humidity packs. They have an incredible selection of rare, limited, and hard-to-find cigars. If you are a cigar smoker, this is the place to go. Smallbatchcigar.com. And they ship everywhere within the continental United States. And you'll get it within 2 or 3 days. So not only great quality cigars, but you're going to get them quick. And they come in those cool little humidity packs so that you know they'll arrive fresh. The main thing to do is just go to smallbatchcigar.com. Use the code GAS10. Get that 10% off and those 5% rewards immediately at smallbatchcigar.com. Let's get back into it.
There is, and a person, I've never even tried heroin, but I've done, I smoke a lot of pot for sure. And there is some sort of a reliance. Somebody made me feel better about it where I go, man, I hope that I don't rely on like being stoned to be funny. But then it was like, it's really not like you're funny when you're not stoned. And then when you get stoned, you get to just kind of write from a different perspective for a couple hours. You know what I mean? Or your ideas just come from a different perspective. Did you find like, I mean, obviously no one's pro heroin, but did you find any artistic like solace in it? Did it do things where you were like, man, if I wasn't all whacked out or had those experiences, I wouldn't even have had this song or these thoughts in my head?
Very easy to answer. None whatsoever.
None.
There's a big difference. Heroin is something that is physically dependent and very quickly turns you into someone that doesn't give a shit about creativity.
Sure.
Or even a roof over your head. And so your life becomes literally get money, score. Get more money, score again. And whether you're homeless or Keith Richards in a mansion, you're still preoccupied with scoring. There's no, maybe right at the beginning, you know, you shoot some dope and you think you're great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But what do you think the correlation, or if there's any, to all these brilliant songwriters who have this like similar history?
Well, I'll tell you a story about a brilliant songwriter that has a similar history, and that's Ozzy Osbourne. And his first number one worldwide album ever was the first album he made completely sober.
Yeah.
Right. Motley Crue too, when they did Dr. Feelgood was their biggest album ever. It's the first time they were sober.
Yeah. So what I would say to it is, I think it's cause and effect. I think back in the 70s also, no one knew the ramifications of heroin. You know, people weren't dropping dead on the streets from fentanyl overdoses.
Yeah.
So Keith in the south of France shooting a bit of dope on top of the world, they're going to write great songs anyway. I don't think that was the heroin.
Gotcha.
I think that these days, no one wants to do business with a smackhead or a crackhead. And the business has changed. And Ozzy proved it. I remember the day he looked at me when it went number one and he went, "And I'm sober." it proves, you know?
Well, because there might be also a fear that if you do, again, if you change, you know, your thing, if someone's like a drinker or something, your perspective changed. Like you almost wear the can, you still write. Yeah.
You all have that fear. And I related to you with the weed, because you don't know. And for years, Ozzy was scared that he wouldn't have it if he stopped doing it.
Right.
And, you know, luckily I didn't have it when I was using.
So Ozzy is actually...
So you can always stand to get it still.
Ozzy's on the lead, the second single from the record, which is called Crack Cocaine. And first of all, it sounds like a fucking 90s riff. Ozzy, like, this could have been on fucking either No More Tears or, you know, any one of those records from the 90s. It's so Ozzy-oriented. And from what I understand, this song had been sitting in the back burner for a few years, that you and Steve Stevens wrote it years ago, and it was Sharon who said you should release this, and that was the catalyst for this record, because you were recording just for funsies for like the entire time of COVID with all these other, with no plan of an actual record.
It's absolutely right. I mean, the first 9 months of I'm quite isolationist. I'm fine if I'm locked in my house for 9 months, because Postmates is my friend and the food is delivered. And you know, I will admit, after about 9 months or maybe a year, I started to value human interaction more. I learned that even I, as a flag-waving isolationist, needs human interaction. But that first year, I've got a beautiful recording studio in my house. Why would I not make music? That's what I do. But I wasn't thinking of making an album. You know, that's why on this record there's EDM samples and hip-hop beats with metal guitars, just because I wasn't writing an album. I was just fucking around.
And a piano ballad. Don't forget the piano ballad too.
Piano ballad as well. But in a hugely generous move, Sharon said, "Why don't you put this song out? Because we both really like it." And to be truthful, it came out so well because that's the result of when friends write music as opposed to business partners.
Right.
You know, there was no pressure. We all know Ozzy's my best friend and Steve knows Ozzy well. So it's me, Steve, and Oz sitting around as friends, no egos, you know?
Right.
Like,
That's a big difference. And also on his podcast, he referred to you as his other son, which I thought was adorable. But you guys have just been, he said that in the interview. He called you his other son. And he wrote the lyrics in like 20 minutes, right? He sat down and did that.
You know, it's got to feel sort of nice, too. I do think that we feel it's never coming with any kind of arts, but the pendulum kind of swinging back, and they say it always does. And I felt like with social media for something and the SoundCloud and all the stuff that it might not swing back, or it might take longer, and it did. But I do believe even the young people are coming back to, like you guys said, like Ralph, like the 90s, like riff of an album, or even 80s. Like, you know, my daughter's 21, so, I mean, I see, like, her friends, like, They're getting more eclectic in music again, even though their main thing is like modern hip hop, I'd say, you know, like she still knows, like, even to go back to the White Stripes or Iron Maiden, because she kind of grew up listening to that, like with me, they developed their own thing. And that's kind of, Billy, what I wanted to ask you with, like, you said there was hip hop elements on this. Is it interesting to have you drawn inspiration from essentially a genre of music that was invented within your time of doing music?
Absolutely. First of all, you're absolutely right, Jay. A couple of guys in Billy Idol's band have got kids, and they notice that our keyboard player in particular, he's got two, like, you know, late teens. And he said, "Dude, they're listening to you know, all kinds of stuff from the 70s and 80s. It's being embraced. I think the vinyl resurgence helped that too, because they go back and they find
Collect.
The Allman Brothers and, you know, NWA on vinyl and stuff like that. For me, hip-hop was just a new punk rock. You know, I am fully immersed that my biggest influence was the Sex Pistols. I was 11 when they came out, and I just loved the complete overreaction of the whole fucking world. Yeah. To some, I swear, it's like, so what? But what it told me is that's how you get heard. You know,
right.
The whole country was up in arms, and I'm like, oh, that's what you got to do to get seen and heard around here. So when hip hop came along, it was just that culture, that group of society, and that age group, it's their punk rock. I mean, I went to see NWA and Public Enemy perform when they were out there. And it was as scary and chilling and thrilling as it was seeing The Clash.
I bet, yeah.
That's you fucking, know, yeah,
so
for
I,
sure.
I love...
so it was raw. It wasn't Hollywooded up or popped up yet.
That's what punk was. It was an attitude, not a haircut. And so what makes me laugh is for my sins, I live in Beverly Hills, right? It's very nice. And I spray paint my art. I do spray paint downstairs. I've got a big open area. So the doors are wide open and there's all these people walking their dogs. And I've got Tupac and NWA blaring out my... And with the jewelry, you know, they say, are you in a band? I say, yeah, Public Enemy.
You know, so you brought it up, so let's talk about this for a second. We'll get back to the album in a sec, but is it true that you are primarily these days making the bulk of your money as a painter? You're a painter first. Oh, yeah. Now, right?
And first of all, music don't pay shit anymore, right? Yeah, I mean, I think if you get a million streams, they give you a couple of grand,
right? It's really crazy. It's so like, sad.
Yeah,
it's touring. I mean, it's all down to touring now, right? Touring is the money now.
Yeah, touring, special shows, private shows, and merchandise. But you do have to be a touring live band to make a proper living, and that's fine. I'm grateful that I am in a good band with good people, and I get to tour. But yeah, the artwork changed my life.
Right, and by the way, I will say I didn't know what to expect, so I went and looked at your website, Billy Morrison Art. And I really fucking like it. And my question was going to be like I love the pink stormtrooper in the cell and all the art, the celebrities that you've drawn. When you draw a celebrity, do you need their endorsement or you can just do that?
Oh, shit. We're going to brush over that question.
Huh.
I may be breaking some laws.
I wonder. I don't know. I just.
Here's how it works. If someone takes a photograph of a rock star, for instance, that rock star has zero rights to that photo. Okay. The photographer owns it. Okay. And I have stumbled a couple of, I've been learning. Look, I'm a punk rock artist as well. I didn't take lessons. I don't know how this shit works. So I've stumbled a couple of times and had to go, oh, I'm so sorry. Uh-huh. Here's some money, you know,
Sharon owns some art, Fred Durst, Shepherd Fairey. There's a butterfly series hanging at the Capitol. That's fucking crazy that's all from a guy who's never taken a guitar lesson, acting lesson, or art class.
I'll tell you this. I don't like the attitude of a cocky photographer. I don't like it. I just bumped into at a thing, Danny Clinch, who's an amazing photographer.
Yeah, I know Danny Clinch.
We bumped into him at this that Gary Clark record release thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was asking simply because I thought I recognized him from when I did Bonnaroo, did the comedy tent at Bonnaroo. And we he took pictures of this thing. He was doing the pictures of Bonnaroo. Here. So when I met, they go, it's Dan, and I forgot the name. So I go, oh, yeah, so you take pictures. You do your pictures for Bonnaroo, right? And he was like, his attitude was just like, for like 20 some years. Like, okay, dick face. You're like, I'm just asking because I think you took a picture of me, you jerk off. Why are you being an asshole right away? I'm asking for a reason.
Yeah.
So do you find your time is on art or is it on music? Like, how do you decide?
Well, there's not enough time in the day for me. That's the truth. I've got clients that now commission paintings, which means they tell me what they want and I paint them. So I've got stacks of canvases ready and that's lined up. Right now it's solo album time. So I, you know, there's,
How specific can somebody be with what they want to commission from you before you feel like you're not doing art, your own art?
I'm not going to paint your cat if that's what you're asking.
What about me? What about me and Jay in a lovemaking position? Would you do that?
I've already drawn it.
Oh, if there's enough zeros on the check, I'll paint anything, mate. No, look, here's the thing.
How about 7 zeros? But there's no other numbers.
That's my number.
It was exclusively zeros.
I am judicious about. I get a lot of requests to do things, and I just have to say no. And sometimes I'm gentle. I'm like, I just don't have time. And sometimes I'm not gentle. You've got to be kidding me. No, I'm not painting that. But usually my clients want something that I've already painted, but in a different color with us. And I'm happy to accommodate that.
Sure.
Yeah, I got to tell you, I really, really liked a lot of your
Thank
stuff.
You
Very
so
cool
much.
Shit.
Thank
now,
you.
There's another thing that I'm not sure I may be getting the details wrong, but it's kind of weird. Back in 2011, you had a guitar that was going to come out, and then Gibson got raided while your guitar was being made, or they took them all. So you never actually got your Gibson guitar released because of something without you.
So very good research, not quite accurate. We were meant to put 250 Gibson Les Pauls out there.
Okay.
We only put 100.
Jay's face. He's so happy I got something wrong.
Oh, hang on. Let me start a chat to everyone. Oh, is this to everybody here?
Ralph got it this? Wrong.
I got 70% right.
Ouch. Oh, ouch.
I'll always call you out if it's
That's
wrong.
Why, no, I told you before we started, I'm not going to get everything right, man.
Half of them. So, the FBI raided Gibson because there was some issue with the wood they were using. And it was like, you know, some special halfway up the Amazon wood that they shouldn't have been using. Mm-hmm. So on the production line, when the feds came through, was 125 of my Les Pauls. So they all got taken. And we only released 125 because we tried to get them back. And the FBI wouldn't give them back. So there was 125 Billy Morrison Les Pauls.
So in some FBI warehouse somewhere, there's 125 Gibsons for you?
Yeah, they're about 15 grand or something now. They're probably funding, you know, some operation on that.
Ralph describes it like it's like Indiana Jones. It's like a warehouse full of boxes. Where are those Les Gibsons?
Exactly. So let's get back to the album, Morrison Project. You definitely brought in some heavy hitters for this. Not only we said Ozzy, also it's Paris Jackson in the video. Is that who that is?
Yes. Yeah.
How the fuck did that come about?
Paris is a fan of rock music. We needed someone to play the woman in the video. And a mutual friend of mine said, "What about Paris Jackson?" I said, "I love her. Look, she's great." And he connected us. I asked her and she was very generous. She said, "Yeah, no problem."
That's really cool. And so now on the record too, Al Jorgensen, John Five, Corey Taylor, Steve Vai, DMC, Linda Perry, who's been on the show, Billy Idol. But what's funny is Billy was the last one to come on the record, which seems like he would be the first one to come on the record.
Well, so no, because if you think about it, my day job is being Billy's guitar player and it says Billy Idol on the marquee, not Billy Morrison. So I respect that position and I try not to ask Billy to do anything. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure that guy gets asked to do 50 things a day.
Right.
Remember the Billy Never Idols ads? Those were my favorite.
That was in New York, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Billy Never Idols.
Billy Never Idols.
That's right.
I also like that there was one time where Billy Idol, Billy Duffy, Billy Gibbons, and Billy Martin were all on stage together. And somebody walks in and goes, "Hey, Billy," and everybody looked.
Yeah, very true. Four of us turn around, you know. Look, the thing with Billy Idol was that after I was sitting on 11 songs, clearly I'd done the record deal by then, and clearly this was going to be a big album. And it was very obvious by his absence. The album is my friends. They're not people that I had to go through managers to get.
Right, so you didn't get a no from anybody because these are all people you know.
Everyone said yes. And because of that, because of the genuinely organic nature of how I got my guests, it was obvious, well, Billy needs to be on the album. So I called him and he said, "Of course." And we put that last song together and there he is.
And
I saw you guys at Jones Beach when you were on tour with Bryan Adams. And
I had a broken arm. I played with a broken arm at that gig.
What a man, great show. I'll tell you what, I went I will say this. I went for Billy Idol only. And I was like, I like Bryan Adams songs. You know, he's got enough hits that I like also. He surprised. He was great. He was amazing too. Bryan Adams. Holy shit.
We were surprised as well, Jay, because when they gave us the bill, Bryan Adams and Billy Idol, we were, because Billy's punk rock and, you know, we're like, huh, Bryan Adams, what a nice guy. Every single gig was sold out and he kills it every night.
Kills it.
Yeah, it was great. Right. But yeah, I had a broken arm. Instead of doing this, you know, strumming, I was doing that because I bust my elbow.
So which track on the record, because you do have so many guest stars, took the longest to finalize, because you are going to be collaborating with people and it's probably your first time, even though you did, like, I think every one of them had at least played in either Royal Machines or Diablo, like some way, shape or form. They're not, it's very, you know, you're all friends, but which one did you like have to go back and forth? Like, all right, that's not exactly what we're looking like. How much did that happen?
I never went backwards and forwards. That's not what we're looking for, but I have a good story about the Al Jourgensen track. So people don't know this because there's no credits on the albums, but I wrote a bunch of Ministry songs for the last couple of Ministry albums.
Wow, that's cool.
And Al and I are very close. And I said, one day I'll call the favor in and you'll sing on a song for me. So I called the favor and he said, no problem, send me the song. So I actually sent him what ended up being Dystopia, which is on the album. It's something that I sing. Mm-hmm. But I sent that to Al, and 2 months later, I had to push it. You know, Al's busy and, you know, does things at his own pace. And 2 months later, I'm like, Al, I need to record this. I need to get your vocals. He's like, no problem. Can you send me the song again? So I sent it. I sent Dystopia again. And he went, oh, shit. I've written a whole song to a 16-bar loop that you sent for the Ministry album that never got used. So I didn't have a... He's written all these lyrics to one 16-bar loop. So I had to create his song overnight, which I did. Mm-hmm. And that was the longest.
But didn't you also, I thought I heard that you said John 5 would be good for this, or he said that.
He said
and then
that.
You called, and that's how that came about, right? Like, yeah. Oh, this would be a good guy for the record.
Yeah. I was at Al's house, and we finished the vocal, and he went, you know who'd be good on the solo is John 5, and he's in my phone. So I texted John, and he's like, I'm a Ministry fan. Yes.
You know, Ralph, where you said about the collaborations going funny, too, because I was in that Corey Taylor with was that the famous story now, the Machine Gun Kelly, like sending the track, and Corey Taylor was like, yeah, I'll do it. And then he sent him the track, and he was like, no.
That's right.
He's like, no, dude, this ain't, you ain't looking for me for this.
And then there was this whole thing on Twitter for ages. Yeah.
It's not a friend. That's why that happened, you know?
Well, I mean, say I'm not a Machine Gun Kelly fan, and I am a Corey Taylor fan, but it is still funny. Like, you can still put yourself in the shoes of like the soul cry. Machine Gun Kelly was arguing after that from the place of how hurt he was. He was just like, here, dude, will you sing this song? He goes, nah, dude, this song sucks. And the Machine
Luckily,
Gun Kelly.
I do not have any of those stories from my album. That's lucky.
Yeah, so far, I've only heard a couple of tracks. They didn't send me the whole thing, but so far, what I've heard, I've loved. All right, before we go any further, you know the drill. If you're over the age of 21 and you live in a state where Delta 8 is legal, and most importantly, you want to get really fucking high, there's only one place to do it, and that's at yodelta.com. If you use the promo code GAS, you're going to get 25% off. That's 25% off your entire order at yodelta.com by using the promo code GAS. Stock up on vapes, stock up on gummies, all Delta 8 that gets you super high, and most importantly, can be shipped to a majority of the states where it's legal. So if you're looking for a way to get your supply delivered direct to you, there's nowhere else to go but yodelta.com, home of Delta 8, that will get you super duper high. Let's get back into it. Is it true that Mr. Dream is based on a politician?
Yeah. And because this is an American podcast, I can tell you who, Gavin Newsom.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's cool.
You know who that is, Ralph? Ralph, do you know who that is?
I do know who that is.
Who is it, Ralph?
Gavin Newsom is the...
come on, dude.
California?
Come on. Are you looking it up?
No. How can I be like...
What's he...
Isn't he the governor of California?
Okay. All right.
Yeah,
that was close, because, Ralph, your first answer was he's something to do.
Well, the way Jay said it, I thought maybe I'm wrong because he said like he was so sure I wouldn't know. Like maybe
I just like ricking people over the coals when your eyes look like you might not know.
I'll tell you what it was, Ralph. It was basically this older woman that Steve knows, like a grandmother. She said, you know, that Gavin Newsom, I have no idea what he stands for, but he's so charming and handsome, I would vote for him. Now, it's not really a statement on Newsom, whether you like him or not, but the fact that a politician, which is really important, can get a vote from someone because of his charisma and his vanity and his charm, that's a little scary.
Yeah, it is pretty wild. I mean, that's, I think, they say that, I saw this somewhere, that every debate ever, because debates are not important. I watched the whole thing about why they're not. But the people that win are just the ones who have more charisma, not that they have better points to be made.
Yeah.
Jay, you look like you want to punch me.
He was telling you the story, and then you drank out of a water jug that was bigger than your head. It was the most distracting thing I've ever been a part of. In all my years of broadcasting,
the most distracting thing. You've seen it.
It's wild, bro. Whatever your fisheye lens is, it like covered your whole head. It looked, it was insanely obnoxious. It looked like you were drinking. It looks like you took the thing out of the water thing at the office building.
I am 6'6", so it would look fine on my end. So also to go back to the record.
Sorry, get back to Franken hosting.
So Linda Perry's on, who's one of the most brilliant songwriters of this generation for sure.
Yeah.
She's been on the show. She's fucking awesome. And you sent her the song with you singing.
Yeah.
And wondered, well, she's going to have changes. She's going to do this. But she said, leave it as is. I'm just going to sing it. But you said you'll never release your version of it.
Hell no. I mean, look, that was a fantastic moment for me as a songwriter, because like you say, Linda's got wall-to-wall Grammys everywhere. She's written some of the greatest songs we've ever had, right? So, of course, she said, first of all, she doesn't do this. She doesn't pop up on many people's records.
Right.
But she's a wonderful soul, and I've known her for a long time. She said, yeah, let me hear the song. Well, you can't send a song without any lyrics and melody. So, and I'd written the lyrics and melody. So I sung it awfully and sent it to her. And she sent a message back, said, this song is perfect. I don't want to change a thing. I expected her to go, well, if you come over to my studio, we'll kind of try this, you know. And she loved my song. So it was great. But no, the world doesn't even need to hear my version of that.
to touch on Billy Idol a little bit, because I think you've been in the band 16 years now, roughly.
Yeah,
I could be wrong.
Like that, yeah.
Steve, who's also been on the show, not to keep name dropping, but he was the one that suggested to Billy, let's make it a two guitar band. And I know the guy. And that's how you got into the band.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, I mean, God loves Steve for that. It changed my life. You know, they'd taken a long hiatus, and when they were planning the big resurgence, the new album, the world tour, Steve said, look, if you listen to Billy Idol's albums, there's a lot of guitar parts going on. It's the 80s. So they were mixed a bit lower, you know, but there's lots of parts. And Steve felt hampered. He can't stretch out and do what he wants to do if there's no other guy. So he suggested the two guitar thing. And thank God, Billy was like, absolutely, buddy, let's do it. And in I was. Straight
really
to
cool.
Russia,
and
I think.
16, so you didn't have to audition or anything. And it's 16 years you're in the band.
I asked when Steve called me, I said, well, do I have to audition? And he just was like, nah, man, you're the guy. And
that's
so, yeah,
cool.
About 4 weeks later, we were in Russia. And I haven't looked back since.
That's fucking crazy. And it's funny because you said most of your friends got famous, then got their drug problems. You did it the other way around. You got your drug problems. Then now you're a recovering drug addict who lives in Beverly Hills, successful artist, a bigger musical career than most people realize. And you just did it the opposite way.
Well, I just feel really stupid because most people sold a couple of platinum albums when they was 18, 19, got a bit of money in the bank, bought a house, and then went and got a really dangerous drug habit. And I couldn't even get it right that way. You know, I came out of my drug habit with nothing, you know, owing credit card companies from that I just frauded.
And in fact, you said one time that I forget who it was, thought you were having heroin withdrawals, but you actually had appendicitis.
Appendicitis, yeah. Yeah, I was saying, you've got to take... I was in Scotland, and I was saying, you've got to take me to hospital. And the band were like, oh, look, we'll get to Glasgow. We'll find you some gear. You'll be all right. And I wasn't. I had appendicitis.
And it's cool because full circle, I think one of the first shows you ever saw, although not the first, when you were 10, you saw Generation X, which is Billy Idol's band, and now you play with them. That's fucking cool as shit.
Yeah, man. It's a great experience. I'm the only guy that actually saw Generation X and understood what that was about. And I guess it's the same for comedy, Jay. Like, when you meet people that saw George Carlin or saw Eddie Murphy back in the day, that I think that must have an effect on what you do now, as opposed to kids coming up now who don't know those original kings of comedy and all of that. It's a different style.
I'm very surprised how many people can get in the comedy. Well, not that they can, of course they can, but I'm surprised how many people... I just assumed when we got into it, we were all sort of like historians on it to some degree. Not that mine went back, that I didn't necessarily watch like the Bob Newharts and the Woody Allens. I mean, I've seen their stuff since and the Lenny Bruce's, but every one of my time as a child, I mean, I can name like all the people that were on Evening at the Improv, you know, all the 80s comics. I just know all of their names and some of their jokes because I watched all of it. I consumed all of it.
I think that's really important. When I was lucky, when I was 11 and the Sex Pistols were happening, I was lucky enough to have a guy in my life that said, look, the Pistols are the greatest band in the world, but you've got to understand where they came from in order to truly understand the essence. So I learned about the New York Dolls and the Velvet Underground and Iggy Pop and the MC5. And I feel that's the same in any creative art, including comedy. If you steep yourself in the history, you're going to understand the craft.
I think a lot of people didn't see. I got to see Bill Hicks a few times when I was a kid. I don't think a lot of people did that.
Nice. Did you also think he was overrated?
I was 11, I think, or 12, so I didn't really have much feelings about it.
You want to hear a guy go up there and complain about advertisers and whatever for 25 minutes? Say something funny, dude. Stop yelling at me.
So, Billy, let me ask you this. Do you help other people that are going through, because you came out of being in a bad place for so long and to be where you are now, do you put out a helping hand? Because I know we talked about it off the air. The hardest thing people have sometimes is just admitting they need help.
Sure. I mean, obviously, don't put my cell phone number up on the screen. You know, call Billy, he'll help you. But I do devote a lot of time to, being in the entertainment business is fantastic. And I'm extremely grateful for everything that's come my way. But my primary purpose is to try and tell people my story, because it's still so stigmatized that if you are depressed, have PTSD, suicidal thoughts, addictions, you can't say anything about it, though. You just got to hold it in. That kills people. It's killed many, many of my friends. So
weren't you friends with Matthew Perry?
I was friends with Matthew. I was friends with Chester Bennington, Scott Weiland, Chris Cornell. Like, the list is fucking endless. And my job primarily is to show people where I came from and what I am now. It's totally possible. I didn't buy it. You know, right. I wasn't given it. You know, this is about telling people anyone can do it.
Great. And don't you have a charity with Dave Navarro, Above Ground? Is that right?
Yeah, I do. I'm going to be pushing Jay to do the next... When we do one show a year, and the next show we do, I'm going to get Jay to come and do a thing.
Dave Navarro doesn't love me.
Oh, really? Okay, then maybe
I don't know if he'll even... But we did... He was on a show... I did a show Z-Rock years ago that he was a guest star on a couple
That's
times.
Right, I remember.
And just like my character is... It was like Curb Your Enthusiasm style, where you kind of make up your own dialogue. It's just, you know, the situations you had to be in.
Yeah.
And my thing was to sort of like make fun of Dave Navarro. And I think he just didn't like, that I was getting laughs in a room where there was like hot chicks that he had, like, all, you know, and he was still, all the girls wanted to fuck him still. I was just making people laugh, I think, at his expense. And I think he did not love it. I want to tell you a funny story too, real quick, Billy, because I think you'll like this. You mentioned George Carlin earlier. So it always makes me laugh. about like being a fan and getting to see somebody and having these moments with them. Joe DeRosa, another great, fantastic comedian. Joe DeRosa years ago met George Carlin. I don't know if they did a show. Ralph, you son of a bitch. You motherfucker with that goddamn.
I still did it on purpose.
Yeah, did you now?
All right, before we go any further, this product is one that I will say I haven't started yet, but we're going to probably be using it very, very soon, because if you're a drinker, this is something you take before, during, and after, and you will feel a hell of a lot better the day after you drink. I'm talking about Capsulite, which is C-A-P-S-U-L-Y-T-E, Capsulite. And if you use the promo code GAS, you're going to get 30% off immediately at checkout. That is the promo code GAS, G-A-S, and you will get 30% off immediately at checkout. This is something that is doctor formulated. It supports your liver, and it prevents that feeling the awful day after you drink, especially as I've gotten older. Jesus, one drink, and it's enough to make me feel like shit. So if you go to Capsulite.com, use the code GAS, you're going to get 30% off, and more importantly, you're going to feel better the day after you drink. Capsulite.com. Let's get back into it.
But he went to do the show with George Carlin, or saw him, and after the show they were talking. He said they had this great conversations, two comics talking, and you know, it didn't even seem like a fan thing or anything. He was talking to another comedian, and it was this great thing. And when George Carlin left, he said to Joe, I remember Joe telling the story. He's like, he said, man, he goes, keep kicking him in the nuts, kid. Keep kicking him in the nuts, kid. And Joe like took that, and Joe went very shortly after and got the acronym for that tattooed on his arm to be like, this is what George Carlin said to me. You know, to keep kicking. What is it? What would it be? K-K-I-T-N-K.
Right.
It looked like kitten from a distance, which was always kind of funny too. But keep kicking the nuts, kid. And then when people started making, like, busting his balls about that in New York comedy, I forget who it was, the techno, who looked it up. But if you look up George Carlin's, like, autograph on things, it's just the thing he says to everyone. It's just like...
And he had it tattooed.
It's since been covered.
Oh, because it was just great.
He gave him his cat. It would be like getting tattooed. Like, you know, Larry the Cable Guy, one time after a show, you came up to me and said, get her done. And I got that tattooed on my neck because I know those words were for me.
They rang
Wait,
true.
What?
They really
oh, that's
rang
what
true.
You say. That's what you just say now when you shake any hand in the world? Ah, shit.
Yeah, like I saw you say, Billy, that when you get together with Ozzy, you talk about chocolate, you talk about anything but music. Like, you've just been friends for so long, you're not going to be focusing on this shit that you just talk about nonsense, right?
Yeah, man. I mean, no one else would even understand our text conversations. and I think we'd both be arrested. I mean, we just text each other absolute fucking nonsense the whole time, you know?
I thought it was because your texts are in Guy Ritchie movie accents. Hey, you bloody baby, blah, blah, blah.
And they actually are. We actually go, oi, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, there he is.
Remember that SNL skit, keep running around the re-row? That was like exactly that. So then lastly, then we have to do the first, because this hour went fucking fast. But Royal Machines, it's just the world's greatest cover band with the world's most talented musicians. Just done for the love of the music, not for fucking albums or for pretense. Just get together and have fun. But it's a very sporadic schedule, if I can even say schedule, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, our drummer is in the Foo Fighters. Our bass player's in AC/DC. One guitar player's in Jane's Addiction and the other's in Billy Idol. Try getting those four bands off the road at the same time, you know.
Yeah.
But that's the whole point of it. It's been going 23 years. And the whole point was, we've all got day jobs and we've all got, you know, markets and numbers and business and all that shit. And we lost the feeling that we had when we were 12 years old and learned how to play our favorite rock song. And so we do that. And it's really successful. And it happens when it happens. That's it.
Which is cool. It actually makes it cooler that it just happens when it happens. And you don't know who's going to show up. You don't know what's going to happen. It just, and I
and
heard
the buzz
like,
is great.
You have like 150 songs that you guys know because you never know who's going to show up and stuff, right?
We're aiming to be that band where if everyone who says they saw us actually saw us, we'd been playing football stadiums across the world. Oh yeah, I saw Royal Machines in 2010. No, you didn't. You know, no, you didn't.
And you know, it's funny. I said at the top of the show, actor as well. And I was going through it and it inspired me. I went and watched Reboot, which is a wildly entertaining movie with Eric Roberts, Ja Rule, Dave Koechner,
really,
and you.
I'm really impressed, bro.
And that was really fun. It was a fun movie.
And I will tell you, I'm so glad that's the one you watched, because everything else is shit. You know? But Reboot Camp is the one I was actually proud of. And that was, like Jay was talking about, Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yeah, you can tell.
You know, they set the scene. And so everything I do in that movie was, it was coming off the top of my head. I love acting. I just don't get to do it enough, you know?
Jay, it's a mockumentary about a fake guru. It's really interesting.
Oh, nice.
It came out in 2020. All right, so we're pretty much, the hour's gone by. We got to do this. We got to do the first now, Jay.
The first time ever I saw concert, did drugs, had sex.
Okay. The name of the show is the SDR Show, Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll Show. We've asked every guest this since the dawn of the show. Your first experience with all three. We start with rock and roll, and we just mean the first concert you ever went to. And because I'm a lunatic, I know it's Gary Glitter.
You are a lunatic, and yes, it was Gary Glitter at the Lyceum Ballroom in London.
Yeah, how old were you?
As long as you didn't see him in Vietnam, you're fine.
I think he flew to Vietnam shortly after that. Actually. I was 10 years. I think I was 9 years old, and my mum took me to see Gary Glitter.
Oh, no, right in his wheelhouse.
Yeah. Oh no. I mean, I was perfect. He was motioning, come backstage.
You thought he was talking to your mom? Like, no, honey. That's for you.
You're like this to the mom. Like, get out of there.
What a bar mitzvah of life.
Oh, it was fantastic.
And now the first drug you ever did after weed, unless weed was not your first drug.
First drug I took was heroin.
And wow.
You'll never get another answer like that.
Man.
Wow, that's crazy.
You must think I'm gay for smoking weed.
And now the first time you had sex.
Yeah, I can't tell you. I've been asked that question many times. I have no recollection.
Because it probably happened.
I know I've had sex. I just don't remember the first time.
Right, but also because you started heroin at 14, it probably happened somewhere in that time frame, I would imagine.
Yeah,
You know what? We've asked this question before, and you might be able to answer this one. Do you remember the first, like, sex you had that was like, holy shit, this is because I just was in a band and, like,
because I'm famous. Billy Clark called it rock star sex. Like, the first time.
The truth is no, because by the time I was there, I wasn't behaving like that particularly. Do you know what I'm saying? And you're right, Ralph. All those early sexual experiences, there probably weren't many because dope.
Right.
I mean, there was one, obviously, somewhere, you know, but I just, my memory is done. Ask me about the 80s, early 90s, and I've got no idea, mate.
Right. Can I ask
one more question? Because this is a real one I want to ask. I see it right away when we started the show. I complimented your Miami Cuban link that I love, and the bracelet and everything. In comedy, it's funny how much I get made fun of. And, like, you know, lightly, it's friends, but I mean, like, for the way I dress and the whatever with the chain, the wallet chain and the things in my pockets hanging out. And I instinctually do it. It's just how I like choose to dress. I don't overthink it really. It's what I lean to. I see it happening in Ralph is 51 years old.
54.
And I'm watching it.
Thank you so
54,
much.
54. Yeah. Ralph's in jogging pants all the time. He says the word comfortable a lot. And I'm wondering, I don't see the end where, like, one day I'm just going to go, I guess these khaki shorts will work out for
but
me. It's just
I used
not
to wear
my
jeans.
Look.
I used to wear a chain wallet. I used to wear rings. Now I just want to be comfortable. It is what it is.
I don't not get it. I'm just saying it's for me. It's I'm also, but also, and Bill, you also too. I perform still a lot. So there's also something about, like, you also want to keep up, like, you want to feel cool when you're trying to be cool in a moment where.
I'm with you. You said the sentence that I related to, which is I don't overthink it. Look, I mean, I'm always, I kind of roll out of bed like this. I cannot ever foresee the day where I go, where's my espadrilles? You know,
I own a pair.
It's just, and let me tell you, Oz is the same, man. It's like he rolls out of bed and he's got jewelry on. And it's just a thing.
Yeah, I'm the same. It's like my nose rings. I'm like, why would I pop them out? I'm like, I don't know why.
I changed when I got super fat during COVID. I just didn't feel comfortable wearing cool shit anymore. And
that's the best time to wear cool shit. Covers up all your bad shit.
Yeah. Also, by the way, Billy, I purposely didn't ask you any questions about Billy or any questions about Ozzy, because I know that you don't tell tales out of school, and I appreciate that. So there's no reason to try and, you know, poke the bear. I appreciate it. So you stay friends with people and work with these people for
but
so
long. But for sure, P. Diddy fucked Usher. Say it out loud. We all know it's true.
So the new album is called Morrison Project. You can follow Billy at Billy Morrison Official. Go to BillyMorrisonArt.com for a fucking really cool art. And some of it's for sale right on the website as well. We add a single every week to the playlist. We're going to add the crack cocaine, of course. But is there anything else you want to plug before we do our plugs?
No, man. I'm just here to shoot the shit with you guys. I'm not plugging.
And also, I appreciate that the whole album, you said you wrote this album just for you. Like, whatever happens, happens. Yeah. There was no pretense to it. Jay, your plugs.
When are we putting this out exactly?
I don't have the schedule for me. The next week or so, it comes out.
I'm all over the place. BigJayComedy.com. Actually, Los Angeles, Netflix is a joke festival. I will be doing the main room at the Comedy Store May 10th, I believe. So tickets for that are up. I'm also doing the Forum with Bert Kreischer, but he's selling tickets fine. Fill up my show.
I also saw him plug you on an Instagram video yesterday.
Yeah. I'm doing the whole Fully Loaded tour all summer with Bert Kreischer, so that's going to be a lot of fun. Dan Soder on all the dates also. Me and Dan doing the whole tour, so that'll be a lot of fun. And then I'm all over the place myself. Yeah.
By the way, Billy, I didn't ask you this one last question. When you say on your Instagram that you're a hologram, what the fuck does that actually mean?
A friend of mine owns a hologram company, and I was the first hologram that he made. And it's bizarre. If you scroll down my Instagram, you can see me playing guitar with me.
Wow.
And harmonizing. It's bizarre. But yeah, I've been made into a hologram.
That's cool. That's fucking awesome. Cool as shit. Follow me everywhere at I Am Ralph Sutton. My other podcast on health and wellness is called The Good Sugar Podcast. The Good Sugar store is on the corner of 3rd Avenue and 69th Street. Giant yellow sign. Come down and eat a vegan meal. No single-use plastic. And we are all running the Spartan race, except Jay's not running. And June 22nd at Citi Field. If you email me or DM me on I Am Ralph Sutton, you could join us for free and waive the $200 fee.
Why don't you drink a jug of water while you sell this?
I'm going to bring it with me the whole time.
You should. Drink and talk like Jeff Dunham.
And we'll add the crack cocaine to the playlist. It has like a really cool bluesy Aussie old school vibe to it. I really dig it. And we'll see everyone next time on the SDR Show.
The way The SDR Show.